Extraordinary. Delve into the harrowing true story of a man who was entrenched in London's criminal underworld. It's a story about much about redemption, about punishment. And delighted to say that joining me live on the line is the author of Extraordinary: The Search for a Life Worth Living, Stephen Gillan. Stephen, good morning to you.
How are you doing? It's wonderful to be here.
Good to have you with us. Just give us a little bit about the background. First of all, congratulations on the book, by the way. Excellent stuff. Tell us a little bit about sort of your life, because it is, if you like, a story in two parts. So tell us about your old life and then your new life.
Yeah, absolutely. Let me say as well, I have a lot of friends in Spain. Part of the story even weaves into Spain. So big hi to everyone over there. How it starts, I was born in the UK, taken to Ireland as a six-month-year-old, really kind of abandoned there, unfortunately. Grew up right in the middle of the war over there. After my surrogate mother died of cancer at 9, I was the young child on the boat coming back to England and the East End. That was the start of it.
And so, again, what was your sort of your education life like? I believe you spent some time in children's homes. In terms of getting the break, Stephen, it seems like you didn't get any breaks whatsoever.
No. The second part of it is, of course, I was a feral child. You know, I was trying to survive. I went through a lot of children's homes, very violent. We used to try and look after the younger ones there. So I was really, really groomed into petty crime, into serious organized crime really, really quickly. I mean, a lot of my role models of the day was, you know, the real target criminals in the East End or wider London. So, you know, I grew up with them, these guys, as a family.
Is that perhaps one of the things, is the fact that I wouldn't say it's an attractive lifestyle, but it's the only kind of option available for you at that time.
Yeah, I mean, excuse me. We're all looking to belong, of course, you know. We're all looking to belong, and I was certainly susceptible to that. You know, I was one of them crazy kids, right? You know, looking back, it was a defense mechanism, of course, but I'd always do more and be more. So, you know, I would stick out as someone, you know, to be used. But the thing you have to remember is a lot of these guys are further along all the way up. Is they've been groomed and they've had the same role models and they've been through the same thing in the same way.
So presumably you started out doing sort of smaller petty crimes and then it sort of escalated, I suppose, as you, I don't want to make it sound like you rose through the ranks, because it tends to give it that sort of Hollywood glamour, doesn't it, Stephen? And that's not what we're trying to do here.
Look, there's no glamour to it. And I give an example saying I knew people for 25 years and, you know, they set me up to get me killed. But it's not. It's not that these people didn't love me. You know, they didn't know me. We hadn't done everything together. It's just in that life, if circumstances turn against you and you're positioned in a certain way, you know, it's as serious as that. You can go just like that.
Mm. You end up getting caught for doing an armed robbery, apart from the obviously thoughts of not actual words, oh dearie me, I've been caught. What goes to ghost? I mean, do you just accept you're going to be doing a prison sentence at that point? Do you just think, okay, well, game's up, and this is what I'm going to have to, looking at a presumably quite a long custodial sentence?
I think it's a lot more kind of normalized and technical than that, because you're really playing a game because you think you're smart. Even then, there was a technological war with the flying squads. There was debugging, there was the directional mics, there was this back and forth. So, you know, it's this really paranoid game going on. But of course, you think you're always one step ahead. But the thing was that when it all went wrong, you know, and it was a red eye, there was shots fired at the police, there was a, you know, very serious business. I'd had three trials at the Old Bailey for armed robbery by the time I got my 17-year sentence. When I stood in that dock, it's weird because I had this premonition that I always knew I'd get a lump of bird, as we call it, a lump of time, which is weird. But you kind of course, we are the architects of what's coming next by our choices, right?
So when the judge said at the Old Bailey, you know, 17 years. What goes through your mind then? What goes through your mind as you get, as they say, send him down, and you sort of walk down those steps, and you know you're going to be doing, as you put it, you know, a lump of bird?
Well, I can take you straight back to the moment. And I remember when it came to sentencing, you know, we'd fought it because there was a lot of shenanigans in that case. They'd moved evidence and all kinds of things, which is in the book. I won't go into that. But they did move evidence and to secure a, you know, a conviction. And I remember when they come back with the guilty, we fought it, of course. We said the police fitted us up. But when we got the guilty, the whole court suddenly was packed with all of these people, these really high-ranking people, right? And the sentences was given out. We got 69 years all in all between us. Of course, I'm just listening for the highest number, knowing the rest is going to be concurrent. So I remember looking at my codee, you know, when he got his and was standing up and he was like holding on to it, and there was just that bit of a shake in his hands. I thought, wow, you know, I mean, it's a very pin-dropping, impactive situation. You really couldn't hear a pin drop in there with this kind of theatre of what had gone on in there. But I remember, you know, I got my sentence and I was kind of stoic, really, in a way. Like I said, I always knew or thought I was going to get a big sentence, you know, the way I was living my life. And I remember shaking his hand when we went down and all the rest of it. And, you know, I said, well, you know, that's it now, Jason. You know, we're going to have to get on with it. Of course, what was to come next is, it's horrendous.
Yeah, I mean, do you think that because you fought against the prosecution and you were, you know, you weren't going to plead guilty, that they sort of had your number and therefore they would make sure you're going to do a hard time rather than put you in a certain type of prison? They thought, right, you fought it, therefore we're going to make sure that you go through the full experience.
Yeah, I mean, there's elements of that. I mean, I remember they always do this in trials. You know, it's about saving money and not going through the big, long, protracted trial. But they come back, you know, my barrister, Queen's Counsel, really big at the time, he went down, he said, Steve, look, I've got to go down, you know, talk to them. But I've gone down and talked to them, and they said, if you plead guilty today, they'll give you 12 years. I thought, you know, 12 years? I said, you get back and tell them. No, I'm not guilty. Of course, I've got 17 was the extra bit. They'll give you the extra bit, you know, for not taking that deal. But during the, you know, twos and throes of a trial at the Old Bailey, and it's real theatre, you know, of course it's in the book, gloves and other things was put in my pockets after the event and all of this stuff. And I can remember, you know, we had this main police officer flying squad in the dock, and of course our thing was to get to the truth because we knew he had moved stuff. And he made a real hash of it. And I can remember looking at the prosecution. He had the other glove in his hand. And, of course, he does this for a living. And he was sitting there, and he was looking at the glove, and he was looking at the, you know, the detective and the thing. And, of course, he knew what he'd done. He was smiling. He thought, you moved stuff in this trial, didn't you, to secure this conviction for these guys.
Yeah. Most people will only get their idea of what it being inside a prison is like from, I don't know, many, probably Ronnie Barker and Porridge or something, or the stylized Hollywood thing. And yeah, and if you go to, you know, I've covered cases and stuff as a reporter, and, you know, and a lot of people seem actually generally shocked when they're sent down, or they don't actually believe it's kind of happening. And then having, on the other side, having been in and visited people, you know, I've been up to Durham, which is Cat A, and that's severe. And nothing, you know, from a nice, quiet, most of the listeners have, you know, thankfully will never see that side of society. But it can come as a tremendous shock to people, especially when it is a Cat A. And so you obviously were in that situation as well. But you were, presumably, where did they send you to begin with?
Well, I went, you know, I went to a lot of units and different stuff as well, because I was a Cat A all the way through. I was even released on it, which is extremely rare because you're meant to come down in category. But, yeah, in them days, there was the Ronnie Barker kind of feel to it because it was that old draconian thing. But then you had some of the newer kind of prisons. It was really high security. Of course, I can only go to the high security places, dispersals, we used to call it. And, Yeah, and even within their units, you know, and I did, you know, as should be said, within that sentence, I'd done, you know, a good 4 years solitary, which is oh. which is 23-hour a day bang up, of course, which is you know, a crazy thing to have to go through.
Yeah, because again, most of us think, oh well, it's they think they're Steve McQueen and the Cooler King, don't they? Basically, they think you should sit there with a bait, you know, and you know, I could do that, but if you are, it's the sensory deprivation, isn't it? It's the fact that there's nothing kind of happening that you can get your head around.
Yeah, I mean, it really does things to your mind, something like that, you know. And the quickest way to, you know, to give it to the viewers is, you know, when you're spiritually, emotionally, mentally, even physically redundant, you know, it's proved to be so detrimental to people that after a while they go stir crazy, they go mental. You really need, you know, it brings you down to the very basis human place, you know, the darkest, most desperate place. But I can tell you that there you really face yourself, you know, what you are or what you're not, which is a quite an interesting dark place to be.
Yeah, because of, you know, the cards that life had dealt you up to that point, and you find yourself there, it would be very easy for you to become institutionalized, and lots of people do, and just go, right, that's it, hands up in the air. When I get out, I'm just going to go back. But you had a moment and you thought, right, this is the rock bottom, this is the limit. So when did that spark sort of light in yourself, Stephen?
It's always the thing about the epiphany, but again, it's a lot more real. Was I knew I wanted out of that life, you know, for many times. I knew, you know, I'd been groomed into it. Of course, I have to be accountable for my actions. I lived that life to the top, to the bottom. I really did. You know, I paid my price, as I should have done, right? But on the other end of that, you know, I still had a lot of goodness in me. So I had to find it. And you're right, I was institutionalized. Because what I can say is, going into a big sentence like that, it's going to take you 2-3 years until it hits you. But on the other side, it's going to take you 2-3 years to get back to a normal living, because you're institutionalized. So there's a bridge there. But, you know, I come to the, you know, the place I couldn't hurt people no more. I couldn't have people look down at me no more. I couldn't, you know, how I felt and what I'd been through. I was really, really lucky to survive or even be alive at that point. So I'd always played by the rules of that life. And when I come out, I wasn't beholden to anyone or anything like that. So I changed everything, people, places and things. And that was the start of that.
But when you do come out and you find yourself standing in the bright sunshine or whatever, and you know, it's very, I mean, nobody wants to know you. I mean, nobody in the real, I suppose, in the other world wants to know you, do they? Because, you know, you maybe are discriminated against because of what's happened to you.
Well, this is one of the reasons why so many people, they can't find the, you know, the circumstance, the intervention, the opportunity, the timing, the courage, the wisdom to navigate that, because you've got all the old guys and they're trying to use you again, they're trying to pull you in. There's always a nick something going on, and, you know, they know you're up for it, and it's, you know, they try and pull you back in. Oh, what's the matter with it? So you've got this kind of really weird, stupid peer pressure thing. And of course, your reputation follows you. But on the other end, of course, that works against you as well, because people say, this is someone you don't want to be involved with, you don't want to employ, can't be trusted and all that. So in this period, really, it's kind of making amends, really. That's how it was for me. You've got to understand that you have a 2 years. Of course, people are going to think like that, right? It's up to you to prove them wrong, right? So you've got a 2 years, you know, of doing your penance, really, you know, and that's what I do. You know, you have to suck it up, you know, and if you mean business, you have to, you know, pay your dues in a way, you know, and carve a different path, make different choices for yourself.
So you set up on your own then, basically. You decided to become an entrepreneur. You decided to get involved in the, you know, in the real world.
Yeah, I mean, I was lucky in a sense, if you want to call it. My family had a construction business, but they didn't do me any favors, let me tell you. I mean, this was digging. We, you know, we used to build roads, so it was groundwork. So, you know, I started as a 70-pound a day laborer. You know, and of course, they rubbed my nose in it. But at that time, you know, I needed that, because I needed to understand, honest, I needed to get my humanity back. But within 18 months, you know, I'd gone on, I was supervisor, I was running men, I was running my own contracts. I started my first own business. So there was the middle bit.
And you got involved in charity. Was that something about putting back? Because, you know, that was like, if you like, food for your soul.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, one of the things we're doing at the moment now is Flowcoin, which is a new, you know, decentralized monetary system. I mean, there's massive brands behind this. There really is, you know, a lot of big sports stars and all that. But the reason why I really love this, what I'm doing, is I'm the charity ambassador there, and they're putting real money, big money, into the charity arm of that, which is going to enable us, you know, to do amazing things in the inner city, right here, right now, that's gonna give people them opportunities. And of course, another part of it was, you know, just to give a more rounded thing about my story. In 2019, I was nominated for an International Peace Prize. So I've continued to do a lot of work, you know, in the right direction, and I continue to do that today.
Why the book, Stephen? Is it to a sort of, as you said make amends. Are you basically making that list and putting your experience down on paper as something for yourself, but B, as a, not as a warning, but as a saying to people, look, it doesn't matter how far you fall, you can come back. Was that the main aim of the book?
It's all of them things. I mean, for instance, look, you know, I do a lot of stuff both sides of the camera now. I'm a CEO of RMC Studio. So, you know, I've just finished a TV series with Ross Kemp, for instance. You know, I've already got stuff up in Sky, premium series. So it's really a 360 of a metamorphosis. I mean, I wasn't on the floor, you know, I was 10 foot under it. So there's all that stuff in there. But really what you've got in there is you've got the jewels at, you know, how did this guy really do it? Because it's the real stuff. What I've really kept to is the authenticity, you know, no holds barred, of the journey, what it was and what it wasn't, you know. And it's really all in there. Of course, it's been optioned to be a film too. And it's already been number one bestseller, I'm privileged to say, in two categories in the pre-sale. Of course, it's out. It's out on the 4th, now, 4th of April.
And, you know, when you look around and you see, I don't know, young guys, young girls who are, if you could go back, as the saying goes, and have a word with yourself, what would you say, Stephen?
I would say be very careful of the people who you have around you in your life, you know, and you have to really stand guard on the edge of your mind, your feelings and your deeds, because this is where you're going to create your life and what, you know, comes next. And it's not about what you see. It's really about having the depth and understanding of what's behind this stuff, what's behind these people, you know, and I really shorten that, you know, to people and say, they say, well, what's the best bit of advice? I say, that's really easy. Always do the next right thing, no matter how hard that is, and you're going to end up somewhere good.
When you sort of pressed that button to send to the publisher, and you had a moment of reflection, did you just think, blimey, well, you know, how did I get here then? Because it has been, you said it's a 360, well, you know, whatever, a complete turnaround. From that moment when you were looking at 17 years to this and where you are now, I mean, inspiration doesn't even begin to cover it, Stephen.
Yeah, a lot of people ask that question, and it's, if you had said to me then, I say, hey, it's all right. You know, in your darkest moments, you know, I never thought I was going to get out there. I thought I'd be killed, or, you know, I'd kill someone in self-defense, really. It was that violent. It was that desperate. You'd never think, you know, that you would get out of there. You know, you'd say, you know, what are you taking, right? What are you talking about? This is just not possible. But do you know what? This is the thing, and it's really part of what the book is about, because I get so many messages from so many people. We all have a dark time, right, on this learning process. But just around the corner, you know, life is limitless opportunity, and, you know, it's living proof that we really can be anything, you know, that we want to be, no matter how hard I'll fall from grace. I mean, it has to be said.
The book is called Extraordinary, Stephen Gill and the Search for a Life Worth Living. It's out on April the 4th. You'll be able to pre-order it via our own virtual bookstore. Stephen, if people want to find out more about you or about the book, do you do the social media thing? Is there a website? Where can people find you?
Yeah, I mean, on YouTube and all that stuff, I get tens of millions of views, really. If you just Google my name, is the easiest way. Stephen with the PH, Gillen, Gillen. All that stuff's going to come up. It's the same with the book. You're going to be able to get the book and stuff like that. And I really, you know, I really wish people an amazing experience with the book, if that's something that they are interested in.
The book is called Extraordinary. It's by Stephen Gillen, who's speaking today. Stephen, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you this morning.
Oh, and you, my friend. I wish you Much blessings for the rest of the day and everyone else out there. Thank you for having me.